Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. We are going to be continuing our interview with Wallace Thornhill on the Electric Universe. This is an absolutely fascinating discussion that we have. He starts getting into some really amazing things on what Earth used to be, what Mars used to be, what Saturn and Jupiter, all these planets used to be, and what a brown dwarf star is, what the sun really is. It's really amazing. We talk about the history of our race, human beings, and how that all fits together. All this new information, archaeology is starting to point to this. NASA's findings, which are not consistent with what they thought it was going to be with the Juno mission, is proving out for the Electric Universe theory. It keeps being like that, that NASA's surprised at what they found, but it matches to the Electric Universe theories and models. More and more professionals are starting to look at the Electric Universe and take it seriously. Divisions of IEEE are taking it seriously. High-level scholars are taking it seriously. It's just the momentum is building and building, and it's because it's being proved out in labs. Super fascinating. It will redefine all of our understanding with science. Our universities are going to be changed. It's an amazing time. I don't know exactly how this thing's all going to work out and play out, but I can tell you having the debates is really critical for humanity to move forward. When the current model isn't working out and their findings are strange and the Electric Universe model is, that's an indication that you need to take this seriously and we need to start having these debates. That's how we move forward as a species, as humanity. But when science shuts alternative theories down and says, I'm not going to look at anything because it doesn't go with my way of thinking, even if their way of thinking doesn't work in a lot of cases, and this does in labs, that's just silly. And we really need to start being smarter when we look at science. So I need to get off my soapbox, and I think the majority of listeners out there agree with me. So let's get back into the interview with Wallace Thornhill.
One of my correspondents wrote to me and said, have you seen this YouTube video by and book by the South African Jan Lamprecht? And I said, no, I hadn't. I'd be interested to have a look. So I had a look at the video, and I then downloaded his Kindle book, and it's called Hollow Planets. And he was an IT engineer, as I was for most of my working life. And he just took the logical approach to the data that the deep seismic events showed. And he came to the conclusion at the end that the simplest model that would explain the when you have a very deep volcano on one side of the Earth, you can pick up the signal the other side of the Earth. And the question is, well, the signal can't go through a liquid core, and it can't go through if it's hollow. What would work? And he said, if the density increases as you go towards the center of the Earth and then it starts decreasing, that would explain it. Well, this is precisely what the Electric Universe model would show. In other words, the inner surface would be like the outer surface, and the density increases as you go down, and the density increases as you go out, and in the middle is the most dense. What that means is that seismic waves that come through the Earth and hit this boundary are curved inwards around the Earth and appear on the other side of the Earth. It also gives you a zone called the shadow zone, which is a bit of a puzzle in seismology. Why do you have a shadow zone? Well, this model shows why. The standard model has to invent an inner core and an outer core and special conditions and blah, blah, blah. It's just all made up to try and fit the data. The other aspect is that these deep earthquakes, are down to 600 or 700 kilometers. Now, according to the standard model, the Earth should be squishy beyond about 100, 150 kilometers down. In other words, it's plastic, and you cannot have shear forces occurring or earthquakes occurring. But here we've got them many times that depth. In this model, it can be solid all the way through. It also gets over the ridiculous problems that astronomers find themselves in by applying a model beyond the point where the spring is broken. You know, it's like applying Young's modulus and then applying it, but the spring is long since broken, but you're still using that formula. They do this with black holes and neutron stars and so on. Well, this says that there is no body called, there's nothing called a neutron star. You cannot make something out of neutrons anyway, because they decay rapidly. But this is a case of applying mathematics where it is inappropriate, or the model is inappropriate. But this is happening more and more now. PhD students, they sit in front of computers and they build models, and they try and get the model to fit. But this is just virtual reality. It's got nothing to do with physics.
Well, so what could that mean for us if we had a hollow Earth? What could that mean?
Happily, it means nothing.
it just is a reality. But what is it? What does it mean for other bodies out in the solar system, though?
It means they're all the same, except down beyond a certain size. The gravity wouldn't be strong enough to form a hollow object. But it helps explain why we found so many peanut-shaped asteroids and comets. It's because if you have a small rotation and there's a repulsive force in the center when the thing is being constructed, so to speak, then the tendency will be to form a peanut shape.
What have you learned about black holes with the electric universe theory? It's not what...
They're totally unnecessary. They don't even occur in the electric universe model.
So what are they explaining when standards mainstream scientists are explaining a black hole? What are they really looking at?
What they're looking at is, in the case of galactic centers, where they tell us there are the supermassive black holes, is a plasmoid. A plasmoid is a special form of electromagnetic form of particles, which are traveling at very high speed in a very convoluted pattern, rather like a donut shape. And, of course, in the center of the donut is where the particles are closest together. So in the center of a galaxy, where the electrical energy and the charge comes in along the spiral arms and then focuses down right in the heart of the galaxy, that object can be less than the size of the solar system, but the energy... And remember, energy and mass are related. That concentration of energy is interpreted as mass by the astronomers, and they say, oh, well, it means there must be so much matter. But mass and matter are not the same thing. Mass is a property of matter, and you can change the mass of a particle by accelerating it, for instance, give it more energy and it looks heavier. Well, the same thing happens in the center of a galaxy. You pour the energy in, and it concentrates down into this plasmoid, the most compact, high-energy form known in the plasma lab, and it appears as like a massive object, but it's not. And, of course, as the energy accumulates, it can get to the point where down the center of the donut, where the particles are closest together, they start colliding with one another. And what happens then is you get jets of neutrons and so on out of the core in both directions. And that's the genesis of quasars. You know, quasars are the matter that's spat out of the centers of galaxies as a means of relieving that concentration of energy. And it's a beautiful picture, really. It's like a biological one. A galaxy gives birth to a quasar. The quasar, over time, its high redshift decreases, its brightness increases. All of this is due to the increase in mass in the quasar because the electrons trail after it and increase the mass. And eventually it forms a companion galaxy, or it forms another object, which then gives birth to others. It's a hierarchy.
It's how it expands because then it starts over. Once it gets rid of that energy, goes out, it starts building up again.
Yeah, I think it's very significant, too, that the man who put all this together observationally was Dr. Halton Arp, who was an outstanding astronomer who was sidelined by his colleagues because he had the temerity to say that, hang on a minute, the redshift is not due to expansion of the universe. It's due to the birth pangs of new galaxies. And it was Subramanian Chandrasekhar who wrote on the top of his paper, "This exceeds my imagination." And on that basis, his paper was rejected and his telescope time taken away.
I don't understand it, so it's dumb.
Well, I mean, science, to do new science, to make breakthroughs, you need imagination. Yes. So if it exceeds your imagination, get out of the way and let somebody who's got the imagination deal with it.
Yeah, exactly. Venus. Venus is a new planet in our solar system as well.
Yes.
Now, did it come with us and Mars, or is it a separate deal?
No, it came, but it wasn't there initially. It was born from our brown dwarf star in the process of adjusting to the sun's new electrical environment. Because stars have different means electrically of dealing with their environment. Our sun has the benefit of a bright photosphere, which has a transistor property, which Professor Don Scott has detailed in our conferences and on our websites. That gives us a steady light output, light and heat, while the power coming in varies, and that varying power causes the sunspot cycle. The in the case of brown dwarf, red stars don't have that ability. All they can do is shed matter. And so in the case of Saturn, the change was dramatic when it entered the sun's electrical environment. It went from the galactic environment to, boom, inside a star's environment. And it switched from being a star to being a comet. Now, comets, we know, shed material. They blow it off, you know. And it can actually be quite dramatic. You imagine that repulsive force inside the star can be overcome by electrical forces, and actually part of the shell is ejected into space. And that's what the ancients witnessed. And that shell was Venus. So Venus is a child of our brown dwarf star, which is now Saturn. Saturn is the remnants of that brown dwarf. And its rings, its brilliant rings, are the remnant of that expulsion.
So when do you think that happened?
It coincides with the last ice age, because we suffered, I mean, you can imagine, being suddenly taken from one environment to another. That change was dramatic in terms of our climate and what we had to go through. And that's also remembered by the ancients in terms of the twilight of the gods and the Fimbul winter and so on, all these legends about terrible cold. And then on the other hand, there's legends about terrible heat too. In other words, we were on a cometary orbit for a short time. None of this is explained by Newton's theory, but once you understand the electrical model, there is a feedback mechanism. Because everything's connected electrically in the solar system, there's the transfer of charge between bodies. Some of it's dramatic in the form of thunderbolts of the gods. Some of it is gradual, like we get now with Mars, when it passes through the tail of Earth, and the Earth, when it passes through the tail of Venus. There are, according to the astronomers, stringy things which reach from one planet to the other. Well, those stringy things are Birkeland currents, which transfer charge. When the bodies are very close, the effect is that the actual masses of the planets change, and the gravitational effects between them force them apart. So there is this feedback mechanism which is totally lacking in Newtonian theory. In Newtonian theory, if one planet diverges slightly from its orbit, there's nothing to put it back. The whole thing will gradually go completely chaotic. Well, chaos is avoided in the electric universe by this tie-up between the charge on a planet and its gravity and its apparent mass.
We're finding, archaeologists are finding advanced civilizations now that existed before the last ice age. So that coincides with a lot of what you're talking about. Now, could perhaps, go ahead.
I was going to say, Velikovsky said that we are the survivors of survivors, and we don't know to what extent the peoples that existed in the prior to the last disaster, how advanced they might have been. We just, when we find things, we try and make stories which fit our preconceived notions, and that's what most of modern science is, unfortunately. But having this new perspective means that there's an awful lot of work to be done, going back and looking at things again, looking at fossils, looking at there's a lot of fossils, for instance, which are hidden away because they don't fit the story. We need to do that. We need to go back and examine them in a new light. And I think that will help and also give inspiration to generations of people to follow, to try and uncover the real history of the human race. Thing that's ever been written.
Well, it's absolutely incredible, and people are talking about it all over the place. They just don't understand it. It's really neat to have, you know, starting to see things come together at least a little bit. And if we can get more professionals who understand it, then things will really start to snowball, which is
that's
what
right.
I'm seeing. I'm seeing a little bit more of a snowball there.
Yes. And that's how I think it will happen. It's, as they say, crowds go mad together and only come to their senses one by one. So we're seeing the one by one, but I'm hoping that will accelerate.
Well, if there was so much turbulence in our soul, I mean, we are describing some serious turbulence. How fragile is our Earth environment now? And how do we keep each other, you know, how do we keep ourselves safe? I mean, that's what our ancients were afraid of.
Mm. Yes, that's right. Everything looks fine now.
So, I mean, this could last for thousands of years, and then all of a sudden another dwarf star comes in, right?
That's possible. And that's the most likely thing. But with the modern infrared telescopes and the orbiting telescopes, the chances of finding a body long before it becomes a problem is enhanced. And I think that's the thing. It will concentrate people's minds on looking for the real causes for things. And the real causes for things are, in this case, these catastrophes, the wandering brown dwarfs or stars, which are very difficult to detect. They're the things which can cause problems in the future. We will become aware of such an object much more clearly when it strikes the outer regions of the sun's electrical environment. And that is very extensive. So we'll have plenty of warning.
Well, does this tie into the whole Planet X thing? You know how there's all these people talking about Nibiru and Planet X and all these things. Mm-hmm. Could that be a real phenomenon based on the electric universe?
Well, of course, it's a reasonable suggestion. However, there's no evidence for it at this stage. The outer planets, and we can include Pluto, I think, all of the surprises found out there are simply because they are bodies that were lost on the way in by previous interlopers. And this is an interesting exercise for somebody, is to look at the similarities between some bodies in the solar system and say, well, is this part of that family or this family? Because we're a blended family. And Pluto was probably lost by one of the gas giants when it came in. And its surface and its strange moons and whatnot simply explained by their having come from a completely different environment. They have completely different histories. It's like a blended family where each member has a completely separate history, a separate story. And this helps make sense of a lot of things because this idea of trying to push everything into the same model, you know, this idea of this nebula hypothesis, which never worked. And yet you look at the planets and they're all so different. And the moons around them have differences. Our moon, for instance, has nothing to do with us originally. It was captured very late. And it wouldn't look out of place as a moon of Jupiter. So there's work to be done there in trying to trace the genealogy, if you like, of the members of the solar system. It, as I say, it paints a completely different story. And it's an exciting one because it offers all sorts of avenues for exploration in future, better directed exploration.
Could Jupiter or some of these other planets be warm, or maybe Jupiter's moons, one of them be warm and capable of having life as we know it?
This question of life in the universe is one that the electric universe has something to say about, and that is that it doesn't develop independently on each body. The information for life is actually outside the cell. The direction, and I think there's plenty of evidence for this, the embryogenesis, if you like, that change from a single cell to a complete organism, is not controlled within the cell. It is as if it has a morphic field, something that Dr. Rupert Sheldrake has done excellent research on. It has a morphic field, and that directs the formation of the creature. That information in the morphic field is held in the ether. Einstein did away with the ether without explaining how you can have light travel through nothing. It's simple. You need the ether. Maxwell was right. You do need an ether. and the Electric Universe proposes a model for that as well. But that ether transfers information, and it does it instantly. It's the same speed as gravity, which is instant. And it means that the information for life is actually universe-wide. And when the conditions are right on a particular body in the universe, then the information is there to allow life to take a foothold. It's it makes more sense, I think, than the random the idea of random mutations and so on. That just it just doesn't stack up. I think Fred Hoyle pointed out that it the odds against were something involving a Googleplex. In other words, there wasn't enough time in the Big Bang theory for even life to have got a foothold anywhere, let alone on Earth. Yeah, it the ramifications of an electric universe are all encompassing.
So, could Jupiter or another planet be warm? I mean, could it not?
Oh,
because
yes,
they say
yes.
They're very cold. Could it be warm, and could it be so it could necessarily have life in the way that we understand it?
It could have a form of life, maybe not quite as we understand it, but I think provided
sure.
there's water and there's infrared radiation, then you've got the energy source. Then all you need is the building blocks, carbon and some of the other elements. But certainly water, carbon, oxygen, well, even oxygen isn't necessary for some organisms. Sulfur is another one,
but,
sodium.
But it could be, it's not necessarily ice cold. I mean, super cold. It could be.
No. In fact,
yeah.
The standard theory has that the gas giants have hot centers, you know, and Saturn, both Saturn and Jupiter radiate more energy than they receive from the sun. Saturn in particular, which is not surprising since it was a star itself not long ago. The whole picture, though, of what Jupiter is has to change following the Juno mission.
Because Jupiter was our sun.
No, Saturn.
Oh, I'm sorry, Saturn was our sun. Jupiter,
yeah.
Now, was Jupiter in our same solar system with us? Or?
I have no evidence for it, although I'm open to, you know, more information. It's unnecessary based on the reconstruction that I've seen from Dave Talbot and Duarte Cardona, although it does appear in some of the videos with Jupiter as part of the system. But I don't know, you know. It is possible, but I find it unlikely and unnecessary for the story so far as it's been put together.
Well, let's get into the conference, because I was looking through some of these speakers, and it's absolutely amazing. Can you share with us some of the speakers and their backgrounds and you know, some of the highlights that are going to be there? Because, like I tell you, there's a lot of them, and they seem very experienced in their fields, and it's pretty impressive.
Yeah. Well, on the first day, Don Scott, Professor Don Scott, the electrical engineer, who has been very active in looking at the electric sun model, and also recently in Birkeland currents, the connection between bodies electrically. Dave Talbot, of course, will be there. Gerald Pollack, Dr. Gerald Pollack, whose work on the electrical structure of water and what he calls EZ water, exclusion zone water, he has more or less shown that life is structured water, because water is actually an engine inside the cell. It separates charge and provides the electricity, if you like, to run biology. We've got Dr. James Ryder, who is going to be talking about SAPPHIRE, our experiment to test the electric sun model. And
so you're currently also running an experiment to test the it's called SAPPHIRE, and you're testing out this
yes,
theory.
That's right. Yes.
I don't want to stop you in what you're doing, but that sounds very interesting. And do you have any any early results from that experience? Or is that what he's going to talk about, what this experiment has been showing?
Yes, he'll be talking about that at the conference. Yes, Monty Childs is the engineer responsible for it, and an outstanding engineer, I should say, with many accolades to his name in the engineering world. He's keeping things close to his chest, I think, to make it
more exciting.
Yes, that's right.
Well, James Ryder, in doing my research, he was an executive at Lockheed Martin Space Systems.
Yes.
And he has experience in many fields, but particularly what I thought was interesting was his experience in quantum physics. And mm-hmm. So he's bringing a lot to the table, like many of these speakers.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, Jim and I have chats quite often, and we found very common views on many things, some of them which are more or less on the frontiers of what we're doing, which will be possibly for future conferences. So he's been a very valuable addition to the team. He's also involved with the Institute for Venture Science, and also with Dr. Gerald Pollack, which is an attempt to fund experiments which are suggested by people who have been more or less pushed to one side by their colleagues because they believed that what they were suggesting was, didn't fit their beliefs. and I think that's a valuable thing. This is the kind of thing that we need to get science moving again. You've got to pay attention to people with other ideas and give them some credit for having thought, deeply about a subject and come up with another alternative. You've got to look at alternatives. We've got Steve Crothers, who's another Australian, and he looks at the LIGO, the gravitational wave detectors, and their so-called results, and points out that even the mathematics that they invoke is not understood. It's incorrect. And so, whatever they've discovered, it's not gravitational waves. We've got Eileen McCusick on the topic of human bioelectricity and the electric universe model. She is what I would class as a citizen scientist because she uses the scientific method to try and understand things that she has witnessed in her work, and she can't necessarily explain, but she's got to the point now where she has funding for a university to examine her work.
What work does she do? So what is she witnessing?
She uses tuning forks to determine or to detect things that are going on inside the human body. Now, this sounds at first crazy, and she just thought it was crazy at first, but the further she's gone, she's been able to actually map a kind of field around the human body, and she can pick things that are going on, both psychologically and physically, inside the body, and also correct some things that are not working for them.
Well, could this be tied into some of the Eastern medicine ideas of the energy flow in your body?
Yes, yeah. This is something that's sort of sidelined by the medical profession, but I think to their own detriment. So, this is because the science, the physics is missing. I've got experts misleading each other about the extent of their knowledge. And the physics is lacking to understand these things. But people know they work. It's like acupuncture and homeopathy and so on. They work, but it's not known why. Well, you have to understand the physics of matter interactions at a deeper level than we've ever done before to understand how these things might happen.
So you're starting to figure out the reasons behind Eastern medicine ideas and why they were. I mean, this is profound, a lot of these things.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. And then we've got a philosopher from Switzerland, Peter Model. And his topic is What Can Matter Be? A Philosophical Approach. He's a fascinating man, and I'm very keen to hear him speak. This will be the first time he's address the conference, but he's been to our meetings before. We've got Dr. Franklin Anariba, who is looking at the electrochemistry of comets, because the things that are detected by astronomers surrounding comets in the coma and so on, the chemicals and whatnot, they're not considered from an electrochemistry point of view to the extent that we feel is necessary. And so he's been studying that, and he's going to give us an update. Some of the speakers, like Dr. Jerry Tennant, I don't know him, so he's a newcomer. And his topic is healing as voltage, the physics of emotions. Well, the mind-body connection is understood in the electric universe in a more complete sense than modern medicine does. So this should be interesting.
Well, one of the things that I read that he's doing, I thought this is one of the ones I noted because I thought it was really fascinating. He also discusses how other magnetic fields and scalar energy can be used to erase emotions, leaving behind memories that do not disrupt our health and our physiology. This is pretty incredible, as it can ultimately lead to a completely different understanding of ourselves and how we relate to others. And that's something that was right. It's incredible. And it ties into a lot of psychology and why we might forget things or not know things that might cause trauma.
Yes, that's right. The amnesia. I think that's really important, because it ties in somewhat with Eileen McCusick's work, and it also ties in with Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, Dr. Bruce Lipton. There's a number of scientists around the world who have various parts of the big picture, if you like. And so this is why I'm keen to see people now bringing in the biological aspects of the electric universe, because if we understand the matter interactions at the cosmic level, I think that will help us understand the matter interactions in living systems as well. In other words, there is a signaling system within living creatures which has nothing to do with electromagnetism, in other words, electromagnetic signals or chemical signals in the blood. It's instantaneous, and this is essential if you're going to have all the complexity of a living creature working as well as we observe it to do, coherently. It means that the entire body must be acting in concert together. It has to be coherent. And there's no answer for that in current physics or in medicine or biology.
So we're there's a field that communicates somehow.
Yep. It's the same thing that holds the planets in orbit.
It also is why animals can sense if there's that tsunami where they all ran to higher ground.
There's a signaling system that is unknown to physics at present, but it's observed in quantum physics, and it's called spooky action at a distance. That is not an explanation of anything. It's spooky because Einstein forbids it.
Because it's just too weird. They didn't know how to explain
It's too fast. It's instantaneous. And yet we know that subatomic particles behave as if they're connected in real time, even at great distances. That's been tested over hundreds of kilometers now. But the very fact that the planets are held in their orbits stably requires that gravity operates far in excess of the speed of light.
Well, if we can understand that, we could communicate. Maybe we could travel at the speed, not speed of light, but whatever that speed is. And we could maybe communicate that quickly.
Communication in the universe, or any advanced civilization, would not use radio waves to communicate. They would use this system.
And it would be instantaneous across the universe. So we could communicate with ourselves.
You could hold the conversation, yes.
We could have this YouTube video to somebody across the universe.
Well, conceptually, it is possible, yes.
That just absolutely fantastic. I mean, just it's exciting. Okay, are there any other highlights that you want to share about the? I mean, you've already just told us a whole bunch, but is there any other highlights that you want to share? Can you give us a little bit of nuggets about the what does this mean to the future that you're going to be talking about, maybe even?
Yes. Well, that's really the heart of it. Is that having a real model of how things work means that the technologists can run with that. and also be more successful and probably less damaging. At present, as I said, technology is very damaging in a lot of ways. It's used in the food industry and in medicine in ways which are not ideal. In fact, they're quite the reverse, and they're inimical to our good health in many ways.
So, so do you think all this chaos and all the warring and just the, I mean, we're in a nut job world right now. Do you think that this explains it?
Well, we do go through these cycles, and we're on the downward run right now. But sometimes to have big paradigm shifts, you need to have chaos preceding it. And when you think about it, Einstein came to the fore after the First World War, and that was chaotic, if anything was. I hope we don't have to go to that extent.
Hope this is the extent of what we're going to see. It's good enough to get these paradigm shifts happening.
Yeah, it'd be nice if people recognize that there is a paradigm shift that can break us away from all of that strange, insane behavior.
Well, now, if someone was trying to understand these theories more, whether they are skeptics or just learning new ideas and have questions, what process do you suggest people go through to better understand the electric universe theory?
I think the best resource we have now, I've got a website with a lot of papers, which hasn't really been added to much in recent years because all of my efforts have been devoted to the thunderbolts.info website. But on there, there are hundreds of hours, I think, now of YouTube videos, and they are getting huge numbers of hits. And I think we have something like 85,000 subscribers. And last count, it was something over 15 million hits on our YouTube videos. Now, they cover all sorts of subjects, and they try to explain in simple terms, plain language, the concepts. We've also got space new, a picture of the day, Thunderbolt's picture of the day, which was set up as a counterpart to the APOD, the astronomy picture of the day. And I think in some ways we have more viewers of Thunderbolt's picture of the day than APOD does. But the idea there is to have regular reports each week on the basis of new news that's come out, scientific news and so on. And it's done by Steve Smith, who's done an incredible job over the years. I don't know how many must be up to the 1,000 pages or more of material that he's written. So there's a huge resource there. And there's also a primers for the electric universe so that you can go along and ask or have certain basic questions answered. But of course, most of the work that we do is all volunteer. And this is the kind of work that really now almost needs a university devoted to the topic.
Yeah, it's getting to that level. Not just one university, but maybe
everyone. In fact, I'd like to write a book for high school students in simple language, which sets all of this out. But I'm under constant bombardment with questions and ideas and also
sure
requests to do interviews.
Sure you are. So is the conference going to be, first of all, if someone who wants to go to the conference, how do they get tickets? And is it going to be available streaming online or, where can people reach this?
The conference begins the 17th of August, I think. And the main sessions start on the 18th. But the introduction and a free night for the public, I think, is on Thursday, August the 17th.
Oh, so now, there is a free night for the public.
Thursday night, I think, is a free night. And you'll hear Dr. Gerald Pollack there talking about weather and easy water. And there's a meet and greet before the event. David Talbot will be speaking, and Dr. James Ryder about Sapphire, a light bringer.
So now that's amazing. That would be worth going just on that, seeing the results of that experiment.
The keynote speak, yeah. And people can book for the conference through the thunderbolts.info website under events. And yes, I think it's going to be our best ever. this one.
Are they going to stream some of the events, or at least have them available later on video, or something that people can maybe pay to download, or something to help raise
yes.
funds?
In the last couple of years, it's been streamed live, but this year, due to financial and other problems, it will be recorded as in the past years, but it will be released in September, bit by bit as it becomes available. So, and you can pay for that, and the cost will be quite low.
Well, that'll be good, because it'll help raise funds for you, but yet keeping it low
yes,
will make it accessible.
Yeah, we have to pay for the these professionals and their television equipment.
Yes. So how can people learn more about you specifically? Because you're the – what is your formal role? You're the chief scientist?
Yeah, I'm the chief science advisor for the Thunderbolts project. But it was Dave Talbot and I who started the whole thing shortly after our meeting in 1994. I set up a website called holoscience.com, the idea being that it's a holistic science. There's nothing is excluded. It all has to fit into this grand picture. So if you want to see some of the early ideas I had, some of which I now regret, but it was a development. I mean, it's always a development, this project, and so we welcome those who think they can contribute.
Well, and I've seen David Talbot's he put out some movies at the beginning where he was forming mm-hmm. his ideas. I thought those were great. Very interesting.
Yes, 1994 was the premiere of Remembering the End of the World. And, I mean, the title I thought was very good because it does give some clue as to what humanity went through.
Yeah, very hard. So, so you're going to be speaking what day?
I'm speaking on, I think, the Saturday, which is the Velikovsky Day. That's Velikovsky's astrophysics, where I'll give a lot of the historical background, the key figures, the ones who will be in the history books in future. And on Sunday, where I talk about future science.
Which is, so you're going to wrap up the conference with the future of where everything is going and
that's
be
right.
inspirational. You know, I've covered a lot of really hard topics lately, and it's so nice to have a topic right now that's really uplifting and it can really make a difference for humanity in a positive direction.
Yes, that's what I hope.
So thank you so much. This, I think this was more interesting than our last one. I mean, not that the other one wasn't interesting, but this was fascinating.
Good. Yeah, I hope it encourages some people to come along.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. And I hope you have a nice evening.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you for listening to the show today. If you appreciate these shows and they're of value to you, I would hope that you would consider supporting the show and going to patreon.com under Sarah Westall. Even a dollar a month really helps. You can get my first two ebooks for free at a dollar a month, and $2 I am giving all my ebooks for free. So it's a good deal too. But I appreciate any support that you could give. Of course, if you don't have the money to give, then don't even consider it. But for now, I hope everybody has an amazing day.